We all know that when it comes to the Olympics, American athletes are making huge sacrifices in terms of the time they spend training and the physical stress they subject themselves to. But they're also making big financial sacrifices. Tess Viglin knows a lot about this. She's the host of Marketplace Money. Tess Viglin, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Callie. I've been a big fan for a long time.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, I think it's shocking, at least for me, to realize what it does cost. Give us a sense of what it does for just your average Olympic athlete. Not, you know, the big ones, just the ones on, you know, on the team.
Right, not Michael Phelps, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I was watching 60 Minutes last night, and they had a profile of him. And the guy has actually been able to build himself this special room in his condo or apartment, whatever it is, where he when he sleeps, it's like he's at 8,000 feet. So he's like training his body. Yeah. So the guy has plenty of money to build this. It sounds like a bariatric chamber, you know, within his apartment. But most of the athletes don't have anything like that. And I actually went down to the Olympic Training Center down in Chula Vista, just south of San Diego, a few weeks ago, and talked to one of the high jumpers, Jamie Nieto. And, you know, he was saying for most of us, we don't have anything. And we are bankrolling this, on a wish and a prayer. He's got two coaching jobs where he goes to high schools and tries to help coach there. He's actually trying to be an actor. So he's got acting jobs here and there. But, you know, there is really not a lot of support in this country for up and coming athletes. We love our winter athletes, but we don't spend a lot of money trying to help the ones who are trying to get there in the first place. And it really becomes something that is put on them.
And, you know, I hadn't thought about this, but, you know, of course, they got to eat and then there's rent.
Right.
I mean, that's before they even
mortgage,
get to the training and the gear.
Yeah. Well, and the gear, you know, some of that depends on what sport you're in, whether it's archery or, BMX biking, that's got to cost some money. For a high jumper like himself, you know, he's got the shoes, he's got clothing. But what he said really is the expense is traveling around to various meets. And that, you know, that can add up. You've got flights, you've got hotel, you've got, you know, rental cars, what have you, and meals, and all that starts to add up. And, you know, you're just hoping that A, you make it to the Olympics after the trials, and that B, you do well there to get some sort of endorsement contract that can help backfill all that money that you have spent up until then.
And I have read that some young athletes that start very young, the parents end up spending hundreds of thousands of dollars because, of course, you start, you know, we love those stories, as you say, when they start at 5 or 6, but then, you know, they're 14 before they actually get to the Olympics. That's a lot of money every year, and they're selling homes and, you know, second mortgages and all the rest. So we should make the point that in other countries like China, the government picks up this. So it's left to these athletes to either find a sponsorship if they're like the guy that you talked to. And he mentioned that he had a little bit of sponsorship, but that didn't cover everything.
Well, no, it didn't. And that was back in 2004, which was the last time that he went to the Olympics. And he had a sponsorship from Nike at the time. And what they gave him was $15,000 a year. Now, that is a hefty amount of money, but when you're an athlete training to go to the Olympics and to go to all these national and world meets, you know, it doesn't cover a lot. And what he also pointed out is that, you know, our Olympic athletes aren't amateurs anymore. These are professionals.
Mm.
And you would never ask, a famous baseball player to play in the World Series for free. You would never ask, a hockey player to compete for the Stanley Cup for free. And yet that is what we ask of our Olympic athletes, despite the fact that this is the biggest sports show on the planet. There is a ton of money sloshing around the Olympics. And yet, you know, the athletes who bring us all those incredible moments, they see very little of that themselves.
And just to be clear, the Michael Phelps that you with the bariatric swimming rooms, maybe they get sponsorship, but really where they make their money is in the endorsements after they've become big,
exactly.
Not before.
The advertising.
Right. Exactly. Right. But that's after. You had to put in all the money before to get to the point where you win 8 gold medals, and then you hit it big.
Yeah, you don't get the Wheaties box before you go.
Exactly. And that presumes that you're going to hit 8 gold medals and all the rest. So anyway,
right. Well, it assumes that you're going to hit a gold medal,
exactly.
You know? And as we know, silver and bronze, at least in this country, with you know the endorsement deals and that sort of thing, they just don't get you as much as a gold. So it's a very small number of athletes who end up making bank on the Olympics.
Well, I hope that when we look at the London Olympics this time, excuse me, we look at it with a little bit more sympathy for those who have at least made the team. That's all I'll say. Now, speaking of money, we got some real issues for folks who have jobs and who've been working all their lives, but now realize that they have nothing or little for retirement.
Yeah, you know, we took a look at this past weekend's show at a couple of articles. I just noticed that these came out around the same time. One talking about the fact that folks are day trading within their 401ks. Now, we remember day trading right from back in the dot-com days where, you know, guys would sit at a computer and they would, you know, trade stocks every minute. And we all know how that went, right?
Not well.
Well, people are, yeah, exactly. And people are starting to do this. They are so desperate as they approach retirement to get some sort of return back on their retirement funds that, of course, took a huge hit back in 2008 and 2009, that they're starting to day trade. Not only that, but we have an enormous number of people, so somewhere around 20-30% of people with 401ks have taken out loans from those 401ks. For reasons that you can imagine, you know, you have a job loss, you have a health problem that isn't covered by insurance, you got to get the money from somewhere. But what's happening now is that people are not able to pay them back. And we have an 18% default rate on these 401k loans. That's twice the amount from 2008. And what that means is that those people are going to owe taxes. They're going to owe penalties on that money that's coming out. So, you know, what this points out to me is that there is a problem in the system that, unlike the pension system that we used to have, you manage your own money in your retirement fund if you have a 401k or a 403b in the nonprofit sector, and you can take it out fairly easily. That's a problem because behavioral economists will tell you that we are not rational about our money. And so all this money should be in, you know, what we used to hear about the lockbox for Social Security. The 401k should be in a lockbox, but there is no lockbox for it. And that means that as people retire, they're not going to have any money because they already used it. And that's a problem with the system.
18% default?
18% default rate on people who are taking loans out of their 401ks. That basically they're not paying it back.
If I recall correctly, because we've done a lot of stuff on student loans, that's pretty close to the student loan default, which is 21-22%.
Exactly.
That's pretty scary. So
it is.
You know, I've read a lot about people not having enough in their 401k, but when you take it out and you end up actually paying more for the use of the money, then you're actually behind the eight ball in ways that you weren't even when you took out the loan. I mean, this is scary.
Yeah, it really is, because what's happening now is we're getting people who are, you know, in their 50s, in their early 60s, and all of a sudden looking at, you know, not only have they not saved enough. In fact, let me see if I can find the statistic here. It was the average 60-year-old has only $115,000 in his or her 401k.
And what should it be?
Imagine going into retirement with that. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the average that the experts will tell you is that you should have around 20 times your annual income when you retire. So, you know, that's nowhere near that for $115,000. Half of the people who are now around 60 years old have less than $37,000. You cannot retire on $37,000. Now, add to that all these people who are taking the money out that they have set aside, and you have a real crisis coming in this country. And in fact, there was a really great op-ed that I would encourage folks to read in the New York Times from Sunday by Teresa Ghilarducci, who's actually from Boston there, and she's been studying retirement for forever. Let me read you a quote from this article. She says, "The retirement system that we have, the 401k, simply defies human behavior. Basing a system on people's voluntarily saving for 40 years and evaluating the relevant information for sound investment choices, making their own investment choices, is like asking the family pet to dance on two legs."
Whoa.
So we have a problematic system here. And it's, you know, I don't know how it's going to get fixed with this dysfunctional Congress, but if folks are looking at retirement, all I can say is save early and save as much as you possibly can and don't touch it.
But Tess, a lot of people, in fact, are not looking at retirement now for these reasons. They can't.
Well, they're not going to be able to. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's, you know, that's part of the American dream, right? I mean, we all grow up hearing that, you know, retirement is going to be out there when we hit 60, 65. We're going to be able to stop working and, you know, try do all the things that we're not able to do during our working lives. And you have to wonder if that part of the American dream is slowly starting to ebb away. And that's a really, really sad statement. But unfortunately, for so many people, particularly in light of the economic crisis that we've just been through, the recession, it's just not going to happen for a lot of folks. They're going to have to work and work and work and work with no end in sight.
All right. Well, that's a somber note to leave, but that's the reality of it. Tess Viglin, thank you so much. We've been talking about Olympic dreams and 401k nightmares with Tess Viglin. She's the host of Marketplace Money. You can catch Marketplace Money on WGBH Sundays at 4 and tune in weekdays at 6 p.m. for Marketplace. Well, it looks like Swedish meatballs and assemble yourself furniture won't be making its way to Somerville. Last week, IKEA shelved its plans to build a store in Somerville's Assembly Square. How will the city fill this empty industrial space? Somerville's mayor, Joseph Curtatone, will join us. I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio.